Welcome to the Phil Mason Show!
Welcome to the Phil Mason Show. That was John Fogerty, center field, on the Friday, February the 8th, 2013 edition of the Phil Mason Show. And normally on Fridays, we bring in a bunch of guys to talk baseball with us. And today I thought we would make a slight departure, considering the fact that the season, or actually their spring training, begins next week. There hasn't been a lot of news. But one thing a lot of people play is fantasy baseball. Many of the listeners of this show play fantasy baseball, and last week, Eric Pleiss and I started talking a little bit about fantasy baseball, and the emails were pouring in, said, hey, can you do an entire show about fantasy baseball? So on the line with me from knuckleballsblog.com, as well as the podcast, Talk to Contact Podcast, is Mr. Eric Pleiss. Eric, how are you today? Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me. And also want to let the listeners know I'm currently doing some part-time writing over at Fantasy Baseball Cracker Jacks. Fantasybaseballcrackerjacks.com. So adding some fantasy tips over there, kind of taking the viewpoint of what fantasy baseball players who are new to the game should be looking to do to get off the ground and be successful that first or second year.
Well, that's excellent. And there'll be a link to that site in the show notes. And definitely, because that's what we're going to do today, Eric, is we're going to appeal to the people who've just begun playing or want to start. And I think what we'll do is just go through the entire process and just be informative today, I guess. The first thing is so many different leagues and formats. There's the head-to-head, there's rotisserie, there's keeper leagues and all sorts of different leagues. Can we kind of go over a few of those? What is a head-to-head league?
Sure, yeah, I think you definitely hit the four main types of leagues. And some of those can have overlap, but mainly head-to-head usually is set up where you have an even number of teams, and then once a week you're matched up against another team in your league. And so for that week, all of your players and stats count against only that other team, and your goal is to win the most categories or have the most overall points only versus that team and only for that 1 week period of time. So anyone who's familiar with fantasy football will recognize that format as you just count the points and totals from 1 week against the other team. Now, that's pretty fun for people who are just getting into fantasy baseball or who are familiar with fantasy football and like the idea of the head-to-head, who like have fun trash talking with other teams and players and like to manage their team, on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I play in a league like that. I have a lot of fun with it, by the way. But then there's the other leagues, the rotisserie league, which is a little bit different, where you have basically 10 teams or 15 teams, and you just go by cumulative points scored, correct?
Yeah, and a rotisserie league or roto league, as they're commonly referred to, this is kind of gets back to the beginning of fantasy baseball. The first fantasy baseball leagues were rotisserie leagues. And you're basically looking at accumulating counting stats for your team over the course of the whole season. So much like the big part of the actual major league season is the long haul, the grinding it out of 162 games. That same type of feeling is within the rotisserie league, where you're not only looking what are your players going to do in a week. So, you can't just rely on a hot streak to get you some wins here or there. You have to be looking to build a team for the long haul. So you need to be paying attention to maybe what guys are getting called up in the middle of the year and are going to get playing time. How does that shift, after the All-Star break, before the All-Star break? So it's more of long term. The thing probably that I like about that is that you can do some more long range forecasting. I think in the rotisserie leagues, in my experience, guys are more likely to do trades because they're looking at guys, especially early in the season, who are underperforming, and they're quick to move those guys. I would say the downfall with a rotisserie league, especially if it's a 1 year league and it's not going to be a year-to-year type league with keepers, you're going to get guys who halfway or three-quarters of the way through the season, their team's going to be way at the bottom, and they're just kind of going to tune out. And so over the last half or quarter of the season, it's really just a two or three-team race down to the wire. So something to think about when you're looking at getting in a league, versus head-to-head and roto, what's going to keep your players, what type of players are in your league, what's going to keep them engaged all the way through the season.
You make an excellent point there too, because if you're in 10th place or 15th place after 5 or 6 weeks, it's awfully tough to come back. I know it's a long season, but it's still, when you have 22 points and the leader has 86 and only four teams go into a playoff, you get these guys that drop out and then you're playing against basically robots and it's not any fun. That's not a league. If you were going to play a roto league for a beginner, I wouldn't do that, would you?
I would definitely stay away from it. I think if you're a beginner and you want to know about roto, it doesn't hurt to maybe enter into like a free league on Yahoo or ESPN.com. You know, one of those you can just get into. You don't necessarily have to know the guys in the league, but just get an experience of it, because it's a totally different animal than head to head. But if you're really looking, you know, just to get into something with your buddies and have a good time, head to head's definitely the place to start, because even if you're out of it towards the last half of the season, you still have an opportunity with those head to head performances to be engaged with other players, have something that you're really fighting for. You know, to make a charge against those other people, the people you know, you know, builds a little bit more rivalry. Whereas with Roto, you don't have that week to week pull. You know, it's just every day you get a couple more RBIs, a couple more home runs, moves you up and down within those categories. So yeah, you can definitely tune out towards the end of those if you're not doing well. So beginner players, head to head. But I think definitely you can't just dive right into Roto. You need to have a little bit of experience or have, like I said, take a couple practice leagues in there to really get your feet wet.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I play in a rotisserie league on ESPN that I don't know anyone on, and I use that as for experimentation. I don't care if I win that league. I'm anonymous on that league, so I don't care. I don't really worry so much, but I use it for experimentation. Pick guys that are maybe thinking about taking on my other teams from the waiver wire or whatever, and just kind of seeing how they pan out. That's what I do with that. Now, there's also this keeper league. Now, can you explain what that is exactly?
Sure. I think the idea behind a keeper league, sometimes referred to as a dynasty league, in these leagues, you're not only building a fantasy baseball team for 1 year, but you're going to plan on keeping your players into the next season. Some leagues will allow you to keep, you know, one or two players. Some leagues you can keep as many of your players as you want. Generally, these leagues then, the talent pool for the following year's draft, of course, will have all those players removed. And so when you're going into, you know, a league like that, you have to understand that now it becomes more important to have younger players on your team. Sometimes if you're a team building for the future, you know, just like in regular baseball, there's going to be cycles where you're depleted of talent. Maybe you have some young guys. And so you have to be looking not only what is a player going to do right now in 2013, but can you afford to keep, you know, a rookie on your roster because he's going to be great next year? And now you're going to be able to keep that guy, you know, through the peak of his career. You know, he could be a guy that's on your team 4, 5, 6, you know, 10 years because you were able to grab him when he was a young guy. So it's definitely more of a commitment, and you have to really be a little bit more into what's happening with baseball and paying attention to not only major league rosters, but to some degree minor league rosters and depth charts, so that you're able to, you know, make those savvy moves that maybe some of the other GMs in your league aren't prepared to or don't have enough information to grab those types of guys. So it just adds another level of realism. And like I said, there's different kinds of keeper leagues. You know, you can still be head-to-head keeper leagues. There's still rotisserie keeper leagues. There's keeper leagues where there's a salary cap imposed, or you know, you can maybe keep three guys, but they can't all have been drafted in the first round when you took them or something like that. You know, with any type of league, there's always different rules with the idea of you want to, at the end of the year, when you go into the new year, have those teams that did poorly previously have an opportunity to still capture some talent, so that it's not just going to be, you know, the Yankees running away with your fantasy league every year.
And the keeper league is really a league amongst buddies, because you have to have that, otherwise people drop out. It's not a league that you can find probably in ESPN or Yahoo that you can just join if you want to, right?
Yeah, usually this is going to be a league, you know, it's going to be set up, at least originally, it's going to be, you know, 5 or 10 guys who know some guys. And then maybe if they're looking to grow a little bit, they might say, hey, Phil, do you know anybody who could come in and take Johnny's place? Because Johnny's, you know, not into it anymore. So over time, it might evolve, but definitely year to year, you're looking to retain as many of the teams and as much continuity between seasons as you can with owners, because then having relationships with other people in the league becomes important when you're trying to, you know, put trades through, trying to evaluate what's this guy going to do on the waiver wire, what kind of players does he like to have. So in a keeper league, the more you can know about the other people in the league, the more that's to your benefit as a GM.
Just like a real baseball team.
Yeah, exactly. The Dynasty League is all about creating more realism, or to give you more of a feeling about being a GM. And there's all different levels of Dynasty League. Some even allow teams to feel, you know, like a whole minor league roster type, where then they have their own feeder system that they can move guys back and forth up to their fantasy roster.
And I would consider that an expert league that you, as a beginner or even a first or second year player, probably don't want to involve yourself with, correct?
Yeah, and it's definitely something you build up to. You know, like I said, you might know a guy who's in a league like that, and he says, you know, hey, Phil, we need another guy here. And after a couple of years playing fantasy baseball, you might get into something like that. But, you know, as with anything, there's going to be a steep learning curve because each league is different. And because maybe some leagues, you know, their scoring categories are more traditional, or they maybe have more scoring categories. Maybe some, like typical leagues, have a 5x5 scoring categories where there's the standard 5 hitting statistics with RBIs, runs, home runs, stolen bases, you know, typical stats like that. And then there may be some other leagues that have as many as 10 or 12 offensive stats. You know, they're going to go stealing percentage, you know, in addition to number of stolen bases, not only batting average, but on base percentage. Maybe they're going to count individual walks. They're going to count strikeouts against you. And so different leagues then become more and more complex as additional scoring categories are added or taken away. So there's all kinds of things to get into, but really just knowing, the more you can know about what type of league that you're in before you get into it, the better off you're prepared then to make evaluations on players when it comes time to get into the draft.
Yeah, you know, I get a lot of questions about these things, Eric. And when they ask me about keeper leagues, I kind of try to put it like this. You know, when you play fantasy baseball, you should be familiar, if you're a beginner, with at least 50 of the top outfielders and at least 10 to 15 of the top position players per position. You should be very familiar with that as a beginner. If you want to get into a keeper league, you not only need to know all the players in the league, but you need to go at least 2 to 3 deep on each team's prospect list, correct?
Yeah, and especially with those keeper leagues, you know, understanding that at any given time, every Major League Baseball team has 25 players on their active roster. So that's 750 guys spread out between the Major League teams. Now, a lot of those guys aren't going to be everyday players, and so they might not necessarily be in your starting lineup on your fantasy team. But you have to know what's going to happen in San Diego when their first baseman gets injured. Who's going to be in line to take up that playing time? You know, and then which prospect might come up from the minor leagues to then fill an empty spot on the bench. So to be able to be an astute fantasy GM, you have to know those types of things. So when you see on the ticker on the bottom line of ESPN that, you know, this guy got injured, you can immediately go to your fantasy league and start making adjustments to give yourself a little bit of an advantage. And with the baseball season being so long, those little advantages spread out over those 162 games is what puts you in position to win your league.
That's exactly correct. And keeper leagues are tough, and they are for more advanced players. And there are other leagues too, and we can kind of like touch over them real quick. One of those is the money leagues, where you have a set amount of money you buy in, and then you buy players off waiver wires, or even if you're not playing with real money, they give you like Monopoly money, and you have to stay within a budget. Now, have you ever played in one of those leagues?
Yeah, I've played in leagues before like that, and generally, you know, those are fun for guys, and generally they're keeper leagues. They're fun for guys who like to build long-term teams, for guys who not only know all the players in the major leagues, but have an understanding of which prospects are ripe to come up. And so these guys or girls who are in these leagues just love baseball. And you have to love baseball to do something like that. Because when you say that I want to take, you know, Mike Trout for $30 or however many dollars it is, generally then the next year you're going to have to pay $30 for Mike Trout. Plus there's going to be a premium added on. And so maybe he's $35 and then he's $40. So year to year to year, his salary on your team grows just like it would in Major League Baseball. And so at some point, he's no longer a bargain. And how long can you then continue to hold on to that player at if he's going to be a bargain? Or when should you, you know, let him go off your team and he goes back into the free agent pool? So it becomes more about understanding projections of players going forward. So you're going to be diving into baseball forecasting systems, whether it's Bill James Online, Zips, Pacoda, you know, or maybe you got your own system that you kind of work with. But definitely it's all about what's going to happen in the future to give you the most room then to make signings or to pick up the next Mike Trout or the next Bryce Harper when he becomes available.
That was well put. I can't add anything to that. Now, there are two different ways that the two main ways of acquiring a team is through the auto draft, or I'm sorry, the snake draft or the auction. Now, the snake draft, can you explain that for us?
Sure. So the snake draft is typically going to be used in one-year leagues or leagues without keeper players. Because the way that works is that all the teams are going to be randomly assigned a draft pick, and the first guy goes one through, let's say there's 10 teams, those teams draft 1 through 10, but then in the even-numbered years, they come, or even-numbered draft rounds, they come back and draft 10 through 1. So the guy that's drafting 10th has a 10th pick in the first round, but he has the first pick in the second round. And generally the reason that snake draft is popular in those one-year non-keeper leagues is because you don't have anything from the previous year to say this guy is the worst, and so he needs an advantage of always drafting first. Instead, it kind of helps even out the drafting pool so that the guy who's drafting 10th isn't always at the short end of the stick and makes things a little bit more equal across the draft line. Now, granted, you know, the guy drafting 10th doesn't have access to a Miguel Cabrera or Mike Trout, but he's going to be able to pick up two guys in quick succession. And so that kind of hopefully takes some of the disadvantage of drafting 10th off of that player and evens the playing field a little bit.
Absolutely, it does. And then there is the auction where you're given a certain amount of money and you start bidding on players. That's always fun too, isn't it?
Yeah, and the auction draft, again, I would say is going to be for the more seasoned fantasy baseball player. And it's going to generally be a lot more fun for leagues where you know guys or know the people in the leagues, and you're going to be able to get together for an in-person draft. Because generally what happens, it's an auction. It's just like it sounds. So someone will nominate a player. And so usually early you're going to see big names come off the board. So someone might nominate a guy like Justin Verlander. And then everyone has a specific number of dollars they can spend to field their whole team. And so then guys will bid on Justin Verlander, $30, $40, whatever it is. And generally a good rule of thumb in the auction drafts is going into the draft, identify four or five players who you'd be willing to pay a premium price for, and then make an attempt to get them on your team, knowing that everyone else is also going to be identifying players they're willing to pay a premium for, so that then later in the draft or later in the auction, when a lot of guys' funds are depleted, then you're able to fill in the back end of your team with guys who cost $1, $2, $3, so that then you're getting surplus value from those guys to make up for the amount of money you had to pay for those earlier guys.
That's exactly right. I like both of them. The snake is kind of easier because a lot of times when I have to draft, because of the time difference, it's like 4 a.m. So a snake is simple. But the auction, you're right. You have to identify 3, 4, 5 guys. And the thing is, you don't want to do is overpay for people. You know, last year I saw Justin Verlander go for $85 on an ESPN draft. And I was like, whoa, what are you trying to do? He's just one player. I mean, you can get 3 pitchers for him. Even though he's an ace, he's not worth $85. Have you ever seen stuff like that?
Yeah, I think definitely, especially in home leagues or when you're playing with your buddies, you see a lot of times those guys who are the most popular players, but also guys from the hometown team. So if you're playing in a New York league with a bunch of New York guys, even though Derek Jeter is an older guy and he's not necessarily going to produce at premium levels, there's going to be some guys who are going to target a Derek Jeter and say, you know, he's probably only an $8 player, but I'm willing to pay $20 for Jeter because I watch the Yankees every day. I think he's a great guy and I want to have him on my team. So you're going to definitely see overpays. And the thing to understand is it's okay to make an overpay if you understand, you know, then at the back of your draft, you're going to have to make sacrifices in other areas. And generally, you're going to get to the end of the draft and you're going to know, oh, well, I paid too much for these guys and it hurt me here because I really wish I could have had an extra $3 to get a guy like Aramis Ramirez towards the end of the auction. And that's going to happen every time. So overpays definitely cost you later in the draft, and you can definitely get sucked into the excitement of an auction draft of a player or a guy that you really targeted, and you say, well, I can give another couple bucks here, a couple bucks here. You know, and some of it is just that machismo of you want to beat the other owner and you want to get that player on your team. But at the same time, that other owner might be thinking, I know that he really wants this guy, so I'm going to bid him up a little bit. And so there's some of that strategy at play, too. The other owners, you know, if they're not going to get a guy, they're definitely trying to bid you up because every extra dollar that you pay is, you know, $1 out of the pool for later in the rounds when they can come in and steal some guys.
That's exactly right. And before we take a break, I want to get into the to mock or not to mock, to get involved in mock drafts or not to. I don't because I don't have the time, but there's value in both, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that mock drafts, especially for the new players to fantasy baseball, are very important. The thing to know about a mock draft is you're not necessarily looking for to build your team and say, oh, I targeted this guy in the 7th round, so I know I can get him again in the 7th round. What you're really looking to learn out of a mock draft is, number one, how do you respond when a type of positional run happens? So maybe you're late in the draft and all of a sudden everyone is drafting closers, you know, and so it gets and you're 5 picks away and the top 5 closers go off the board. You know, at that point, do you need to then reach for a closer and get someone later in the game? Or can you kind of hang around for a while and pick up your next closer later on? So it helps you develop your draft strategy, but also it lets you know, like I said, there's 750 players that are active on a major league roster at any time. And so it gives you an idea, oh, hey, I forgot about this guy, or, oh, okay, I see this guy's average draft position is in the 5th round. So he's not really the 3rd round talent that I saw, but if he's still hanging around in the seventh round, that means, oh, maybe there's some guys in my league that might fall and I can then get value on them. Or conversely, you know, this is a $55 player in most mock drafts. So if I'm at my home auction draft, I know that anything over $55 means that there's some guys in my league who really are overpaying for this guy, and I just want to get away from him.
That's exactly right. That's excellent. That's why sometimes I wish I did mock drafts, but I have a pretty good idea what I'm doing, and I have friends like you who are experts at it, so I'm okay. All right, what we're going to do is we're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to take a look at tips on how to play the game, player evaluations, player rankers, sabermetrics, and little tips along the way that Eric and I picked up to possibly help you have a better draft. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Phil Nason Show on these amazing affiliates. We'll be right back.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show. Been dreaming of that Greek vacation? Well, if you have, then you might want to check out the folks at the Aridi Grand Hotel, located in beautiful Corfu, Greece. Come experience world-class cuisine as well as the hospitality that Greece is legendary for at the Aridi Grand Hotel. You can find them at aridihotel.com or email them at reservations@aridihotel.com. This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit Phil Nason's Welcome back to the Friday edition of the Phil Nason Show. It's February the 8th, 2013, and today we're taking a departure from our normal hot stove baseball program, and instead are bringing you fantasy baseball with fantasy baseball crackerjack writer, Mr. Eric Bleiss. Eric, now this entire draft, it could be kind of overwhelming for the first time entrant, or even for a second year guy, depending on how his experience went the first time. How much stock do you put into player rankings and evaluations? Because I can tell you, I know that when you play ESPN and you do a snake draft, it's their ESPN's evaluations is how they order the draft, or at least the player number for the draft. Yahoo works the same way. What kind of faith do you put, or how much faith should someone put into player rankers and evaluators and this and that?
Well, I think there's definitely some value in there in recognizing where other people, especially people who are, you know, fantasy gurus, are putting value in other players. But the thing to understand, like we talked about before, is there's all these different types of leagues. And those lists that come out that are ranking players on fantasy value, they're generally geared towards a very standard or straightforward league. And so you have to be able to look at that list and say, well, how would it change in my league? Or what are the particulars of the guys in my league where these values would shift? And so, you know, at some point, what's the difference between a guy who's ranked, you know, 330th between a guy who's ranked 450? You know, that's 100 spots. And at the back end of your draft, that's not such a big deal. But again, that could be, you know, 5 or 6 draft rounds apart. And when you're in a fantasy baseball draft, generally there's going to be, you know, almost 25 or sometimes 30 rounds, depending on roster requirements in your league. And so you're going to have to really know a lot of those back end players. And you're going to have to then at some point understand, you know, the value that's on my team and where I need guys will allow me to make a reach here or a reach there. And so for me, those lists are a good starting point, and then I'll use them to adjust. And then what I like to do, rather than strict numerical rankings, and I think it makes a lot of sense, especially for, you know, drafts that are happening in real time, is to put your players in tiers. Because, you know, say these are the top 5 first basemen, and I definitely want to have one of these top 5 first basemen, but I can wait and get the 5th one because there's not a lot of difference between the top 5, but after that, there's a huge drop off. So keeping tiers of different positions and different, you know, if it's an auction league, then tiers of value or where you want to spend your money, because, you know, like I said, the difference between 1 and 5 isn't always huge, but then there could be a big drop off. And in some positions like second base or shortstop, you know, when you're in a fantasy league, you're looking at offensive value. And so there's not a ton of power hitting or offensive, big offensive guys who play middle infield. And so maybe you're more willing to spend a second or third round pick to cement your middle infielders, knowing that there's going to be plenty of first baseman, third baseman, DH guys who can come back and maybe add some more of that home run or RBI totals to your team so that you can get value there later in the draft and then have some of the premium guys up the middle. So tiers are important, rankings are important, but just understand that your league is a specific, you know, entity, and that league doesn't that ranking doesn't necessarily fit your league. So be okay to move some guys around. You know, those guys are experts, they made a list, but that doesn't mean the difference between a guy ranked 17th or 35th is really that big if it's applied to your league. So just be willing to be flexible when you're going with those lists.
Those are all great points. And you know, the one thing that I try to stress to people is this: don't take someone else's opinion and treat it as the gospel, because everyone has an opinion. Do your own research. It doesn't take that long these days to go over to Baseball Reference or listen to a couple different podcasts. The Towers of Power podcast is like a 3-hour show almost every week. But those guys, Jason Collette, who's been a guest on the show a couple of times, those guys know what they're doing. Fantasy Baseball Cracker Jacks, another site to go check out. Fantasy Baseball Dugout, Fantasy Baseball Cafe. Look what those guys are saying and compare it to your own notes. It's better to actually take your own notes first and then go to the experts and see where you're at, where your eye is. And once you're able to do that, these evaluations and where they're ranked by the experts at Yahoo, ESPN, or wherever, you know, you'll be able to see the difference and you can make a good call, because at the end of the day, the experts aren't playing your league. You are. They're not the general manager of your team. You are. So take control of your own thing. Do your own homework. It doesn't take that long. Now, one of the things I always tell people to do, and this is just me, is you have to evaluate what your scoring system is all about. For example, how many players are allowed to start? Most leagues, Eric, that I know of, allow you to start 5 outfielders, 1 shortstop, 1 second baseman, 1 catcher, 5 starters, starting pitchers, 2 relief pitchers, a neutral type pitcher, a third baseman, and a first baseman, and a DH. And what I try to tell people when they're drafting is this: you've got 30 Major League Baseball teams, and that means you have 90 starting outfielders. 90 guys are going to start on opening day, but there are only going to be 30 shortstops, 30 second basemen, 30 catchers, 30 first basemen, and 30 third basemen. Am I too far off there?
No, there's definitely value in understanding. There's this idea of positional scarcity. And so I think, especially if you're in a league that just says you can start 5 outfielders, it doesn't matter if they're a left fielder or a center fielder or a right fielder, they're all going to be lumped together as outfielders. Then there's definitely a lot of guys there, but you still have to understand maybe of those 90 outfielders, maybe there's really only 30 that you want to target. And that's still going to be larger than when you look at middle infielders and say, well, there's really only 15 I want to target. So there's definitely going to, you want to place a premium on guys who play at a position where there's less guys. So that's important to do, but then you have to say, well, maybe I can get 2 great elite outfielders because other guys are going off of middle infielders earlier on, and I can make up value by having elite players here and be willing to stretch there. So you have to be willing to be fluid, but definitely understand not only what guys are available, but what's the strategy of the other teams in your league.
Yeah, that was kind of where I was headed, because in the draft, when you look at, for example, let's say, for example, you have Ryan Braun, who across the board seems to be one of the people picked as the best player for fantasy baseball. And let's say, for example, you have Troy Tulowitzki, and you have a choice between the two. Now, for me, I'm going to take Troy Tulowitzki because I want to cover my shortstop right now. I want the best available shortstop right now. I can pick up 2 outfielders that will equal 1 Ryan Braun. That's my theory anyway. This is how I do it. How do you start? How do you look at your draft? How do you approach it, Eric?
Well, I think you raise a good point there, although I think specifically this year I might be a little bit lower on Tulo coming off of, a leg injury in 2012. But definitely, if Ryan Braun is available in your league, he's probably one of the top 3, 4, 5 players. He's in that next group of elite players after Mike Trout and Miguel Cabrera. So he's a guy that I would take before I started going after middle infield, just because he's going to provide so much surplus value above and beyond, the difference between Tulowitzki and the next best shortstop. Braun is that much head and shoulders above. So I kind of, with that idea of a tiered drafting system, what's the difference between Braun and the next guy versus Tulo and the next guy? But what I like to do when I'm drafting, obviously I come in with my own draft sheets, my own tiers and rankings, whatever I want to look at. But one of the most important things for me is to look at what are the players that my other teams are going after. So I'm not only tracking the players that I'm drafting or bidding on, but I have a running list of all the other guys that the rest of the league has put onto their team, so that when I get later in the draft, after the first 5 or 6 rounds, when you're trying to decide if I take this guy right now, or can I wait and get him on the way back or in a later auction? So you have to say, and you have to be looking at what are those other teams that are drafting between you, or what are the other guys that are going to come up or likely to be nominated for auction right now? And if you know what players the other teams have or how much money they have left or when their next draft position is, that gives you a little bit more information to make a judgment call on how much money or how high you want to draft a guy. Especially in the later rounds where, you know, maybe everyone has all their outfield positions filled. You know, now you're okay. You can let some outfielders go by or try and grab some outfielders for a dollar because no one else is going to be looking to draft or spend money there. And I think in fantasy baseball, more so than fantasy football, because there's so many more draft rounds, draft fatigue sets in for a lot of guys after, you know, usually about 10 or 12 rounds. You know, you've been drafting for, you know, 2 hours maybe already. Guys are tired. They're getting bored. The chit chat in the draft room is kind of down to a minimum. Now you have an opportunity, if you've been tracking the other teams, to really get some extra value in those late rounds because you're able to, you know, maybe let some guys continue to pass over them because you know they're going to be there. You know they're going to be added. You know, so that's definitely something I like to do is track very closely what the other teams are doing, because if you're able to do that and stay on top of it, the late rounds is really where you're going to be able to build a winning team.
That's great advice. Great advice. See, not everyone has the same system, but it's great advice all the same. Now, in a standard game, you have five categories of offense and five categories of, well, pitchers. Or pitching, you can call it batting and pitching. Runs scored, home runs, runs batted in, stolen bases, and batting average. And then on the pitcher's side, you have wins, saves, strikeouts, earned run average, and walks plus hits per innings pitched, or we call it whip. Now, how early would you take a closer, for example? Because last year, I took, in the two leagues that I played in, I had Mariano Rivera, both leagues, and he went down, and that kind of screwed up my entire summer. How early would you look for a closer, and how many closers would you draft, Eric, or how many closers do you normally try to draft?
Well, I think closers are something, especially if you don't have an elite guy, like Papelbon, you know, is okay to have, you know, Francisco Rodney or guys like that, they're okay to target earlier. But the thing about saves is there's really not going to be a huge difference between the save totals of Jonathan Papelbon and, you know, whoever ends up being the closer in Cleveland. Because they come in at such specific times, you know, it's the ninth inning when your team has a lead, you know, and then they have to pitch well once they get into the game. And so maybe the difference between Papelbon and the 10th best closer might end up being, you know, only like 10 saves. And that's, you know, that's not a lot. So that later in the year when you're looking for waiver claims or you're seeing teams changing who their closer is, you have an opportunity to, you know, go in and kind of vulture some saves. And so I don't put a premium on closers just for saves. What I like in a closer is a guy that is going to get saves, but also who is going to get a lot of strikeouts. I think usually those things go hand in hand, but not necessarily so. I think, you know, you saw a couple years ago, the Twins' main closer, even on, you know, their 95-win team in 2010 was Matt Capps. And Matt Capps was never a big strikeout guy. He was kind of a guy that just got the job done. Had an okay fastball, but didn't really do a lot. And so he wasn't a guy that I would ever target as a closer because saves were really all that he brought to the table. So you want a guy that can also strike guys out. So he's helping you, you know, when he is in there, you know, you can count on him for not just one strikeout every appearance, but hopefully for two strikeouts every time he gets in there to make an appearance. And I would usually not go after a closer, probably if it's in a snake draft, probably until the seventh or eighth round at the earliest. And in an auction draft, I, you know, assuming like a $200 budget, I really wouldn't be willing to pay more than about $15 for a closer, just because there's going to be, you know, tons of turnover and change late in the season. You're going to be able to find guys who step into that closer role and really supplement that value and spend your money or spend your draft picks somewhere else.
Those are all great points. Now, when you pick pitchers, do you like look at the National League more than the American League, because National League pitchers, especially starting pitchers, pitch against other pitchers. So that's like two outs right there, or two strikeouts usually. Almost a gimme for every starting pitcher in the National League. How do you do it? Do you discriminate that way, or do you just go by the sabermetrics and the whips, or how do you do it?
I think it's definitely fair to put, you know, some extra value on those National League pitchers, especially if they're, you know, staying with the same team. They have generally the same lineup around them, because you can then be more comfortable relying on those numbers. And like you said, they get the added benefit of usually facing the opposing pitcher two times, you know, in a start. So they have an opportunity to decrease their ERA, increase their strikeouts artificially just by the benefit of facing that opposing pitcher. But at the same time, you know, the numbers are the numbers. And so you shouldn't be looking at picking a third starter from a team, you know, at the bottom of the NL Central. Now, you don't want the Cubs' number three starter ahead of, you know, the number two starter from the Tampa Bay Rays. You know, so it's more than just what league they pitch in. It's what is the value of that guy. At the same time, with pitchers, the thing you want to watch for is, you know, a lot of times when you're looking at these rankings or draft sheets, all the numbers are generally tabulated, at least initially, from what players did in the past. And so while you might want to bump up a guy that moves from the American League to the National League, you're going to want to make a similar regression in the opposite direction for guys going from the National League to the American League. And again, you want to look at what's the defense behind them. Is it a ground ball pitcher who is now, you know, going to have a speedy defense behind them that's going to get to those balls? Or, you know, is it a ground ball pitcher that's all of a sudden pitching in Detroit and there's going to be a lot of singles bleeding through the holes in that infield? So you need to look beyond just who that pitcher is, but look at what the team is going to be at, what league or what division he's going to be pitching in, so you know a little bit about the caliber of the talent that's he's going to be going against on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis. So with pitchers, I think you definitely have to be a little bit more informed, you know, not only about the player, but also his team.
Excellent advice. Excellent advice. We've got a couple more minutes, and I just want to ask you, how much emphasis do you place in sabermetrics?
Well, for me, I think that it's important to know sabermetrics, even if you're, you know, in that standard 5x5 draft. You know, none of those scoring categories are, you know, sabermetrically inclined. You know, batting average, it seems more and more, is less of a factor when actual GMs are making player moves. And we know that RBIs are not such a, they're not really an indicator of player talent, rather of team talent and opportunity. But knowing sabermetrics lets you, especially for me, I use it a lot when I'm making in-season trades or looking to make waiver wire pickups, because I can see that, you know, let's say a guy like Johnny Peralta, you know, he's not a guy that's going to be particularly valued in one league or another, and but maybe at the beginning of the year he's really hot and his batting average is up around 340 all of a sudden. Maybe he had a couple early home runs, you know, and so he's got a high value. There's going to be owners in the leagues that are going to be looking to either move that guy off their team because they recognize he's at a high value, or are going to be looking to acquire that guy because they think, oh, he started hot, he's going to be my guy, I want to get him on because this is going to be his year. Being able to dive into the sabermetrics and look at what his performance really has been to this point. You know, so you're going to want to look at things like BABIP, batting average on balls in play. Generally, this is a number that's fairly volatile from year to year, month to month when you're looking at the player. And so you might say, you know, the average player has a batting average on balls in play around 300. But then you look at, you know, Johnny Peralta and you say, oh, the only reason he's hot right now is because 45% of the balls he hits are going for base hits. You know, so he's not only getting really lucky, you know, that's part of the surge. And at some point that will come back down and he'll be the same old guy you thought he would be. And so, you know, as an owner, that gives you some more information there. You can look at, you know, how many opportunities has he had to get these RBIs? Maybe, you know, he's getting more RBI opportunities early in games because he got moved up or down in the batting order and the guys in front of him are playing really hot right now. And so he has more opportunities. And you gotta, you know, expect that over this 162 game season, those things are going to generally come back to league average. And so when I'm looking to sell players from my team, I'm looking at guys who are outperforming what they should be doing. And so I can send them to other teams who are looking to add value. And then when I'm looking to maybe grab a guy off the waiver wire, I'm saying, who is really underperforming right now, where I can expect his statistics or his, you know, some of those sabermetric numbers to push him back up, you know, get closer to the player he should be. And so those things really I look for when I, like I said, in-season acquisitions, trades, or waiver wire pickups. And then they become less important for me in the draft. And then as the year goes on and we get closer to the end of the season, you know, then they're less and less important because now what the player is doing right now is more important than what you think he might do over that longer sample size.
All right. Awesome stuff today, Eric. Thank you so much for being on the show, dude.
No problem, Phil. Happy to be here.
All right. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. Special thanks to Eric Pleiss for being here talking fantasy baseball. If you have any questions, comments, or whatever, please feel free to come to philnasons.com. Leave me a voicemail, contact me, and we'll answer them the next time Eric is on the show. You all have a great weekend out there. Take care of yourselves. And most importantly, thanks for listening. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.